Okay, so here's a picture of a black hole forming from collapse of matter in space-time. Space-time diagram, the horizon is born at some event and moves out, and this is the singularity inside. And if something is thrown into the black hole, for instance, the matter that formed it in the first place, or another particle or whatever, that carries some information, it looks like once that matter or information crosses the horizon, it's lost to the outside universe because the horizon is a causal boundary. Here's a picture of the light cone. Nothing inside the horizon can ever get out again. If physics respects relativistic causality, the information seems to be lost. Another way information gets lost is from the vacuum decay of Hawking radiation. So we have a pair of vacuum fluctuations inside and outside the horizon. Just like in the vacuum of flat space, they're in some entangled quantum mechanical state that's part of the vacuum, but the one on the outside manages to climb away and become a Hawking particle. And its partner that it's quantum mechanically entangled with falls into the singularity, lost forever. And so the state of the Hawking particle, since it was originally entangled with its partner, taken by itself, is a mixed state. It's like taking a singlet state of two spins and only looking at one of the spins, and it's in a completely mixed state. It could be either up or down with equal probability. So there are two sources of loss of information, it looks like, when you have black holes, one from the vacuum and one just from anything that happens to fall in. So, because of this, you know, back when black holes were starting to be investigated and understood, and when Hawking discovered the Hawking effect, Hawking supposed that black holes destroy information. And that is, people on the outside lose information. If the black hole were to evaporate away completely and have nothing left, then that information that had gone onto the inside is somehow presumably either destroyed, or maybe the singularity here is a portal to a baby universe, and the information goes into the baby universe. But as far as outside observers are concerned, it's lost forever. That seems like an inevitable prediction of this picture. And it's certainly what I thought for many, many years was the actual result. And some people suggested that, well, if the black hole goes away completely, maybe right at the end, it sits there for a long time just dribbling out the information, because we don't know how to describe what happens at the very end. This part outside the black hole and near the horizon, we feel we have control over. At the very end, if the horizon shrinks down to a tiny thing with Planck curvatures, then we really don't know what's going on there. But for information that falls in, let's say here and here, to come out at the end, it would have to sort of, you know, not get lost in a baby universe, but somehow scoot along the singularity for a really long time. Actually, not a really long time, a really long space. Because this is actually a space-like direction inside the black hole, and it's very far. Actually, the distance from here to here for a macroscopic black hole is huge when this gets close to the singularity. So you'd have to imagine also that somehow in the neighborhood of the singularity, there's a giant distortion of the causal structure of space-time, or a giant non-locality in the physics that somehow keeps this information from colliding with the singularity and sort of shunts it off to the end point of evaporation, which is a pretty implausible scenario, but I guess we don't know what happens at the singularity. So those were the kind of things that were discussed initially. A certain class of physicists argued back then and from the beginning that actually, if information were destroyed by black holes, it would be a huge problem for physics. It would be a disaster. And there are various arguments that were put forth for that. And I personally never bought any of them. That's why I said for many years, decades, I've thought black holes destroy information. So what kind of arguments are those? The first one you hear sometimes is, well, if you destroy information, the evolution is not unitary. Quantum mechanics is unitary. Therefore, black holes violate quantum mechanics. Therefore, we're in really big trouble. We can't give up quantum mechanics. But that argument made no sense because it's not that black holes violated quantum mechanics. It's that the Hilbert space presumably had a part outside the black hole and maybe a part in the baby universe or something. And so black holes could just be a process by which the Hilbert space splits into factors that are disconnected, but still one could have unitarity in the bigger Hilbert space, including both factors. So the idea that we violate the principles of quantum mechanics if black holes destroy information on the outside, I think, doesn't make sense. There were other arguments, like that one would get rampant pair creation of black holes from the vacuum, or that rampant violations of energy and momentum conservation would happen. I don't want to take the time to explain why people, what the arguments were for those statements, just to opine that I don't buy the arguments. So despite all of those arguments, I never thought black holes could do anything but destroy information, and it didn't seem like a problem. However, there are some convincing arguments that black holes, in fact, don't destroy information as seen from the outside. The first one that came along is in the context of ADS-CFT duality, where we have a picture of an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, which we can think of as having a conformal boundary at infinity. This is the boundary. And there's a conformal field theory on the boundary. And inside there's gravity and eventually string degrees of freedom, so some string theory inside the bulk. And somehow that whole theory inside this bulk is supposed to be equivalent to this conformal field theory on the boundary. And that's the famous holographic duality. And this conformal field theory is just a standard quantum field theory. And unless conformal field theory doesn't make sense for some reason nobody's ever discovered, we have a unitary conformal field theory on the boundary. This is unitary. On the other hand, we can describe in this setting something like the formation of a black hole and its evaporation by sort of shooting things in from the boundary and making a black hole. Let's say we all the time, and then the black hole could form and maybe evaporate away completely. And the Hawking radiation could reach infinity. Anyway, whatever it is that's happening inside here in this gravity theory, it's dual to, supposedly in ADS-CFT, something in the conformal field theory that's evolving unitarily. So if you're an observer in this boundary, you never lose any information. You know what you sent in, and you know what comes back out. You don't have to even wait until it comes back out to get the information of what you sent in. You never lost the information because everything evolves unitarily in the boundary forever. So, I'm interested in talking about a black hole that forms from collapse.
Black hole, which will then turn into gas
I could actually make an eternal black hole, apparently, by throwing in enough stuff. But it would still be a pure state in the boundary, so it wouldn't be equivalent to this 2CFT story exactly. But it might actually be. I'll come to that later, actually. Let me put that aside. Right now, I just want to discuss this kind of a process. Okay, this is in asymptotically anti-De Sitter boundary conditions. And you might say, oh, but I'm interested in asymptotically flat space, so I don't care about that. But that's a shallow answer, because here's a perfectly good example of a quantum gravity process where black holes are created. There are boundary observers, and it seems like the boundary observables evolve unitarily. So it certainly gives you pause, because every argument that led you to believe in information loss here seems to apply here. And yet, if you're just talking about information available at the boundary, it's never lost. So I found that pretty impressive. My first reaction, though, was to think that maybe the boundary theory is so smart that it knows how to describe baby universes. In the conformal field theory, there could be baby universe states. But actually, this doesn't make any sense either, because the baby universe, once the black hole evaporates down to nothing, whatever that state is of that black hole that's behind the dead horizon, the new piece of the universe has no energy. So there would have to be states that don't register any energy in the CFT, but still have a lot of, I mean, there have to be a part of the Hilbert space that has no energy, but a lot of states. And that doesn't exist in CFT. So I tried every way to wiggle out of it and finally had to concede that something's wrong with believing in information loss is inevitable if you believe in ADS-CFT duality. Now, you could say, I don't believe in ADS-CFT duality. The evidence is only partial. Maybe it's wrong. But the evidence is pretty impressive. But let me say that there's another argument that doesn't even use ADS-CFT duality, which is the thing that finally clinched it for me personally. Because even if ADS-CFT duality is somehow wrong, there's this other argument that just uses quantum gravity, which finally made me stop and say, okay, there's actually a paradox. So the other argument is due to Don Maroff. Unitarity argument. This argument, the key ingredient is diffeomorphism invariance. Key ingredient. So I tried to boil this down to the simplest possible statement of it. Let's consider a diffeomorphism invariant quantum gravity theory, even classical gravity theory to begin with some in a space-time with a boundary. So it could be an asymptotic anti-De Sitter or asymptotically flat or maybe some other asymptotic boundary. But I do need a boundary because I want to invoke the fact that the Hamiltonian for such a theory has the following form. It's got a bulk piece that's Lagrange multipliers times constraints, and then it has a boundary piece. So in the case of general relativity, these constraints would be like the zero mu Einstein equations, g zero mu minus 8 pi g T zero mu. These are initial value constraint equations. The fact that we have initial value constraint equations among the field equations is a consequence of the symmetry of the theory, because the symmetry of the theory means that the evolution is not determined, because you could always apply a diffeo and get a different solution. So it must mean that some of the equations of motion are not really equations of motion, because if all the components of the Einstein equation were equations of motion, everything would be determined from initial data. So some of those equations must actually be constraint equations. That is, they don't have second time derivatives. They only relate the first time derivatives to the fields. These are the constraints. Now, observables in such a theory, like in any gauge theory, should be gauge invariant. So the second key ingredient is that we only, well, it's really the same one. We only talk about observables that are Diffeo invariant. Must be Diff invariant. In terms of, we could express that as saying that an observable must have zero Poisson bracket with the constraints in classical Bayes space. And that means that when we look at the time evolution of observables under the action of this Hamiltonian, the bulk term will give nothing, and only the boundary term will play a role. So this implies that H O is equal to H boundary O. Now, what Maroff says is, let's consider, among all the Diff invariant observables, just the ones that are localizable in the boundary. So the idea is like what I was alluding to here. The observers at the boundary have some things they can observe. Those are the boundary observables. Like all observables, they commute with the constraints, but they live in the boundary. So their time derivative is given by a Poisson bracket of two boundary operators or observables. So it's again a boundary observable because the collection of all observables in the boundary forms an algebra. So this implies that the boundary observables evolve to boundary observables. All right, that's classical. Now we can quantize by just putting hats on everything. Turning the Poisson brackets into commutators. And we get the same statement that the quantum mechanical observables, boundary observables, I'll call them, evolve under time evolution into other boundary observables, unitarily because the Hamiltonian is Hermitian, and therefore no information accessible to the boundary observer can ever be lost. It's an almost trivial argument. I don't know why it wasn't stated like that long before ADS-CFT was ever invented. It's so simple that it makes one nervous that it's somehow trivially wrong also, but I don't see any way that it's wrong. So okay, so what's the big deal? Yeah.
Then when there is no form, just a boundary.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, if you mean localized on the boundary, but not localized within the boundary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just some, I mean, if this reasoning was valid for a finite boundary, then, you know, I agree with you. Isn't there any subtlety with the fact that, in fact, I mean, in order to have a Poisson bracket in the boundary, you need this Poisson bracket to be conserved, and that's why you need to go to some kind of system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you take any finite boundaries, then energy can be held, there's no conservation of the Poisson bracket. So there's a limiting process there, and I don't know. I mean, is it clear that you're not losing something in that process, or that somehow the type of things you see at infinity is, or let's say, you know, it's not exactly the type of things you're talking about here? Because if you try to, you know, there might be an infinite redshift factor.
Okay, so I think the question is, does the boundary algebra of observables capture all the observables in the theory? And this argument, I don't think, says anything about that. So it's perfectly possible that it does not capture them all. So we should keep in mind that the only inference we're making is that if you just consider observables at the boundary, that those evolve unitarily. So it's a kind of S matrix statement. In fact, we know that we could imagine a universe that's closed without any boundary. And if all observables were at the boundary, then that universe would have no observables. And that sounds wrong, although it's difficult to put your finger on the observables. And anyway, so probably there are observables that are not in the boundary algebra. But I don't need to, and I don't want to get into that for this talk, because I'm just trying to address this question from this sort of S matrix perspective. What does a boundary observer see, and do they lose any information? And if they don't, what does that say about what's happening in the bulk? How can it possibly be that a boundary observer doesn't lose any information, and yet, from this picture, obviously information gets lost inside the black hole?
Boundary would be sky plus and sky minus. Right? So essentially, you know, if you're on sky minus in the sense you mean, but you have to go through sky not and then go back to sky plus. So I mean he's going through that particular point, you know, it might be that at some point, let's say the unitary evolution, that is sky zero is the end of time.
You're asking about the asymptotically flat case.
For instance.
Yeah. Yes. So in that case, Maroff tried to argue in a kind of sketchy way that his argument tells you that you have unitary evolution from scry minus to scry plus. I must say I haven't dug into it enough to understand it. It seemed subtle, and I don't know if it's correct. Another thought I had was for asymptotically flat space, you might be able to use spy instead of scry. That's this notion of space-like infinity, where you take a hyperboloid and let it go out to infinite distance. And only if the fields satisfy the appropriate falloff can that make sense. I don't know to what extent it would make sense, but it might be a way to deal with asymptotically flat space. But look, the issue here is sort of matters of principle. And I think that worrying about, since we have one example of asymptotic boundary conditions where it seems manifestly that we have a paradox, we should just focus on that rather than.
Oh, but even there, I mean, the worry for me is more general. It might not be valid. The fact that I have a unitary evolution, but it might be that the notion of infinite time on the boundary doesn't correspond to infinite time here. You see, that's this example of sky plus sky minus. There's a natural notion of infinite time, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not infinite time. So I would worry about that type of. If you could allocate that, then I would agree that the ADS-CFT, you know, say something. But maybe I don't know enough about ADS-CFT.
Okay. I think you can alleviate that for a black hole that's a small black hole that forms by collapse like this and evaporates in a finite time. Non-local in the boundary? Well, there are a host of problems that come with putting hats on, you know, operator ordering, in divergences. we should ask if the theory is UV complete, given that it's got quantum loops up to arbitrary energy. And all of this, the hat argument is assuming that all of those things work. Yeah, so one possibility would be there is no consistent quantum theory with where you put the hats on and you preserve the structure. But on the other hand, we have the example of ADS-CFT, which seems to be an example where it does work, although, and I wanted to make this point, so I'm glad you asked it, it does it in a way that is in the context of a presumably UV completion of the gravity theory. So here, what's inside the bulk is not just gravity, but it's really string theory. And if we just take the sort of general quantum general relativity point of view, that's not by itself a UV complete theory, and probably that means that this argument is strictly formal and doesn't make any complete sense. It should be taken in the sense of UV complete the theory, but still preserve the structure because you're preserving Diffeo invariance, something like that. And in fact, because the UV completion is a crucial thing, because the Hawking radiation that comes out from the horizon is, there's a sort of transmigration of degrees of freedom from a trans-Planckian regime into Hawking quanta. So whatever we see at infinity that comes out of the Hawking process has been processed through the trans-Planckian regime. And so if that's not UV complete, then there's no complete story here, and all bets are off. So I should have added plus implicit UV completion. Okay. Good. So what's the paradox? How can the information get out? It looks like we are not losing information, but it looks like we are losing information. See, do you just push this? How do you get this? Ah, okay, what am I? What's the organization here? Mid front fixed. Okay. Should I leave it? Should I use this? All right, so this has been emphasized recently, the nature of the paradox, by Samir Mathur initially, and by this AMPS collaboration. Amedy, Maroth, Polchinski, and Sully. These are the guys that introduced this term firewall. Mathur talked about something he called the Hawking theorem. And it all comes down to basically this. Let's consider the horizon, some late time bit of information associated with a particular Hawking particle and its partner, so a late partner. And these two guys are in a quantum mechanically entangled state because that's the nature of the vacuum state. It's just a way of expressing the local vacuum of the quantum field that's doing the Hawking radiating, is that you can express it in terms of entangled pairs of vacuum fluctuations on either side. And then we have all the radiation that came out earlier. And I'll just represent that by another dot on this picture. This is the early radiation. And the way these people were posing the question was they were saying, can the S matrix for black hole formation and evaporation be unitary? That is, can all the Hawking radiation, when it finally comes out, taken together, be in a pure state? So in particular, the early part of the radiation might be in a mixed state. It looks very thermal, but in the end, it ends up being correlated to radiation that comes out later in such a way that, taken as a complete whole, all the radiation is in a pure state. This would be the picture with the burning piece of paper. We take a piece of paper in a pure state. We shine a laser on it in a pure state. It starts burning. All these photons go out. Photons are streaming out. The state of all those photons is mixed, but they're correlated to jiggling around atomic processes in the paper. And eventually, when everything streams out to infinity and you gather up all those photons, they're in a pure state. So the thinking was, that's sort of what has to happen for black hole evaporation to be unitary. The early radiation is in a mixed state, but it better start getting purified once about half of the radiation has come out, because if it's later than that, it's too late, because there's not enough late time radiation to purify the early time radiation. So about halfway, it better be that a late time bit is actually entangled with the early time radiation. But now we have a problem, which is that this poor bit can't be both entangled with this stuff and entangled with this stuff. Entanglement is sort of something that gets used up. It can't be entangled independently with different factors in the Hilbert space. So this can't happen. What Mathur's Hawking theorem referred to was, he said, well, can I make small modifications of the states of these pairs in such a way that I do end up imprinting sufficient information in these entanglements to restore unitarity? And he proved, using bounds on entanglement entropy, that the answer is no. There's something called strong subadditivity for the entanglement entropies of subsystems that precludes that possibility. The way Amps put it was to say, well, look, we know the evolution is unitary, so this late time bit has to be entangled with the early radiation. Therefore, we know it's not entangled perfectly with its partner like it's supposed to be. Therefore, the state near the horizon is not the vacuum. It's actually an excited state. In fact, it has to be very excited. And if it's the least bit excited, by the way, if you just trace it backwards in time because of the redshift, it'll have very high energy density at earlier times, exponentially rapidly increasing energy density, and you'll have what they called a firewall, by which they simply meant you'll have a highly excited state that will destroy the smooth space-time picture near the horizon. That's a paradox, because if you have that, then the whole basis for thinking that you have Hawking radiation in the first place is gone. So it looks like there's a real paradox. And then a stream of papers erupts on the archive where people are either saying, yes, we have firewalls, or no, we don't have firewalls. Okay. But we should notice that the question they were asking was the wrong question from the beginning, because it is not that the S matrix finally between the in state and the out state is unitary. The argument, at least the one that I find convincing for unitarity, says that every step of the way at the boundary, the process is unitary. No information is ever lost. That means from the time the first Hawking quantum reaches the boundary, it arrives in a pure state, not taken by itself, but taken together with everything else that can be measured in the boundary. It must be in a pure state. The whole boundary state, the whole state as viewed in the boundary, must be pure. That's what Samir Mathur asked me when I was visiting him last week. And it's on my list of things to think about. Sorry. He said, can I make this argument for the piece of paper and the laser taking into account the coupling to gravity? It seems to me, absolutely. There's no reason, nothing was special about a black hole. The argument has to apply for the piece of paper also. Then you can start to worry, but gravity is pretty weak, isn't it? And is there really enough imprinting? But let's put that off. I mean, I will partly address that. So let me just write something. They asked the wrong question. Because the boundary evolution is continuously unitary. So something must be wrong with this picture. What's going on in this picture is that we have the argument of this entanglement being used up once you do it one way or the other comes from thinking about this as a tensor product of the Hilbert space of the late partner, the Hilbert space of the late time bit, and the Hilbert space of the rest of the radiation. The strong subadditivity theorem for entanglement bounds applies to such a situation when you have a Hilbert space that has tensor product factors. Do we have such a Hilbert space here? Of course we do if we're just thinking about quantum field theory in a curved background spacetime. However, remember, the only reason I believed in unitarity was because of Marolf's argument, which said the crucial thing is Diffeo invariance and what comes along with it, the constraints. The observables must commute with the constraints. So in terms of the states, we could say, in Dirac quantization language, the states must be annihilated by the constraints. So the state space we should be thinking about here is the one of Dirac, the states annihilated by the constraints. Maybe I'll do it over here if I can figure out how to lift the board. So in the quantum gravity theory, the state space is the kernel of constraints. So by which I mean so usually these are looked at in terms of a group of the spatial components and the time component. The spatial ones on a space-like hypersurface are associated, they are the generators of spatial diffeomorphisms. And the meaning of this equation is that psi, which is a function of the metric on this slice, the three metric, or whatever dimension we're in, and let's say our matter fields on the slice, should be a diffeomorphism invariant functional of those fields. So you can't just write down anything. It has to be diffeomorphism invariant in the sense of three-dimensional diffeos. And the zero component, if this is the translations of the zero coordinate, corresponds to what's called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So let's say Ci psi equals zero is spatial diffeo invariance. And C naught psi equals zero is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. It's a second order functional differential equation where the derivatives are derivatives with respect to the metric. It's a strange equation and it has to be satisfied. So if we take the Hilbert space, a function, if we take the pre-Hilbert space of functions of metrics and fields, that may be a tensor product like that. But once we just look at the kernel of these equations, it's no longer a tensor product. So there's no reason anymore for this limitation to be satisfied. In a sense, these degrees of freedom are not independent of these degrees of freedom, because they all have to be tied together in a way that satisfies the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. A simple analogy I thought of for this that's probably too simple, but I think it might help, is just imagine that you had 3 spin-1/2 degrees of freedom in a tensor product. That's like the pre-Hilbert space. And then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the statement that the total spin is 1/2. So I'll say the J total squared minus 3/4 acting on this state, whatever it is, this just represents some state in that Hilbert space, should be 0. So what are we left with? We can think about it this way. The outside pair can be added together, and they sum either to a spin 0 singlet or a triplet state. And in order to get something that's got spin 1/2, that means I should either multiply this 1/2 times the singlet of this pair or this 1/2 times the triplet of this pair. And in this half times the triplet, I have another 1/2. And I have a 3/2. Because 1/2 times 1 equals 1/2 plus 3/2, representation-wise. So out of this 8-dimensional Hilbert space, the constraint only allows 2 states. And the nature of those states is there some mixture of these all the basis states in the original space. And the space of those 2 states, those 2 spin-1/2 states, is not a tensor product of the original degrees of freedom. I can measure which state in my 2-dimensional spin-1/2 space I'm talking about just by measuring this pair. I can tell if this pair is a singlet, then I've got the first one I referred to. And if this is a triplet, then I have the second one. So just by measurements on this pair, I could tell if I was in an eigenstate of one or the other of those 2 spin-1/2 states. Earlier today, William Donnelly pointed out to me that I can't measure everything about this state, and I think that's right. So in some sense, this analogy fails, and although I'm not so sure that in the gravity case I can measure everything on the outside. Yes?
Just a question here. This example is not very non-local. Can you have an example where you own one nearest neighbor? Like a chain. 1, 2, 3,
I'm so glad you mentioned the word non-local. So what is the nature of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation? It is non-local. In 2 senses. One of them is going to be your sense, but first let me mention a different sense. Classically, the constraints, remember, are these components of Einstein's equation. So the zero component is the zero, zero component of the Einstein equation. It relates at the Newtonian level, the Laplacian of the potential, to the energy density. So that's an elliptic equation for the potential, and elliptic equations are completely non-local. So this equation at the quantum level is somehow non-locally tying together everything on this spatial slice. And in that sense, I think that is a good analogy for it. Excuse me. Okay, so, yes?
A related question. You mentioned about in the fall, things may be non-local, but in this boundary theory, whether the boundary Hilbert space have the local tensor product function, or even that is much more because we cannot assume.
It may not, but I don't care at all about that, because the question is only whether a complete set of measurements in the boundary, whether local or not in the boundary, ever loses information. So I think it's a separate question. I think it's actually known also that, for instance, in the CFT, there are non-local observables there. Certainly, there are many non-local observables.
Is it
necessary that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation always gets rid of that tensor structure? I mean, could there be examples where it preserves it?
Yeah, this is, I was going to say, can this be shown?
Yeah.
That's exactly next on my note. Does it work? So this is just a recent line of thinking for me. I haven't started trying to do it, but it seems like a natural question is, let's simplify. Let's consider spherical symmetry. There's actually a worry because we have Birkhoff's theorem. So at the classical level, if we had like a nested spherically symmetric shells of matter, we couldn't tell on the outside anything except what the total mass was. So this sort of gravitational imprinting on the outside is only partial. And it seems worrisome to me that it's not clear how you would ever encode this information. On the other hand, it's essential that we're talking about a quantum theory. And so we have sort of off-shellness all over the place in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So maybe thinking about it classically is the wrong way. But definitely, that's a program now. It seems, because I believe this story, I'm very motivated to try to understand what the Wheeler-DeWitt equation really does in terms of picking out the structure. And does it really encode the information?
So
like
fair to say it's a conjecture that that is going to remove this problem.
Yes. Well, here's, right. So here's, let me stress the logic. The logic would be, it's a, Merrill's argument tells us that something removes the problem. Merrill's argument hinges on the constraints. Therefore, I presume the constraints remove the problem. But can I show explicitly that they do? So far in this sense, no. But I'd like to add a second argument using the constraints, which is due to Laurent, which is rather intriguing. So let me get to that now, which I think almost does show that it resolves the problem. You have to flip around. Let's see, can I raise this one more? Or I want to raise this. That's what I want. There we go. Yeah? Yeah. I haven't thought about that. Off the cuff, it sounds like it should be possible to explore perturbatively, but that's a very superficial answer. I just haven't thought about it. So what's the second argument? It's to take the same symmetry, the same idea of the constraints, but instead of singling out the Wheeler-DeWitt the constraint that corresponds to initial value constraints on a space-like surface, single out the constraint that is constraints on a time-like surface. And that gives you a different Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which you can call the radial Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So let's take surfaces of some radius, like a cylinder. This is from Laurent's. This is Laurent's explanation of the relationship between the holographic nature of ADS-CFT duality and sort of canonical quantum gravity. So if we consider these surfaces of constant R, then in the quantum theory, we also have the constraint that generates deformations, let's say, to larger values of R. And we could think of a wave function of values of the metric on these surfaces, metric and fields. If we take the surface all the way to infinity, and we're in the asymptotically ADS case, we just have a function of all the way at the boundary. And so we have a function of the boundary values of our bulk fields. And that, in the ADS-CFT context, is known to, that wave function is related to the generating function for correlators in the CFT. So it contains the same information that the CFT has. It's like a quantum mechanical wave function of the boundary values. And what this radial Wheeler-DeWitt equation tells us is that we don't have to evaluate it at the boundary. We could evaluate it at some other radius, let's say here, or some bigger one all the way at the boundary. They all encode, in a sense, the same information. Remember that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a second-order functional differential equation. It's also kind of a hyperbolic, not elliptic, in the sense that the conformal factor of the metric derivatives come in with the opposite sign from the rest of the degrees of freedom in the metric. But the conformal factor of the metric is related to the radius in the asymptotically ADS case, the metric on this on these cylinders. So what Laurent said is that we should think of this equation as a differential, as a evolution equation in the direction of the conformal factor of the metric. And given the initial wave function and its first derivative, we can integrate that second order equation and get the wave function at any radius. So from this point of view, it seems kind of like manifest that, I mean, it's very sketchy, of course, but that the information at any radius is equivalent, whereby information, I guess strictly I mean the wave function and its first derivative in the radial direction, radial in the metric sense, that is in the conformal factor sense, that information could be encoded at any radius, but it's the same information. But if that's true, then the whole picture of information spread out through the bulk that's in a tensor product is completely wrong, obviously, because it's all encoded at one radius, in particular at the radius at infinity. And so I would say that's a second argument. The radial Wheeler-DeWitt equation implies that all info in the state is available at infinity. OK. I'm going to get to one more argument, and this is good timing. So what I'm addressing, yes? No, the thing is that the conformal factor of the metric is playing the role of time. In the same sense, maybe it's easier to think about it in the cosmological setting. Go back to the usual Wheeler-DeWitt. Derivatives with respect to the scale factor of the universe are time derivatives for everything in the wave function. So it'll evolve everything. OK, so again, the logic is, we believe, or I believe, it's unitary on the boundary, but then how did the information get out? What went wrong with this, with these arguments and this subadditivity property of entanglement entropy? And sort of how does the information manage to get out? And I'm answering it either by the spatial Wheeler-DeWitt equation, the radial Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And now I'm going to give a third description of how, which I just learned from a really remarkable paper. This is going to be, so far I've been discussing it from a quantum gravity side. Now I'm going to flip around and talk about it from the boundary side. So from the point of view of the boundary, the arrival of a Hawking quantum is just some fairly localized event in the CFT on the boundary, like blip, there's a Hawking particle. And I said it must be in a pure state with everything else in the boundary. So the boundary theory must be able to describe this partner. It's not that this is not entangled with this. Locally, of course, if you go down there and you look near the black hole, you're going to see this entanglement. But it has to be that the same entanglement can be seen just all in the boundary when this particle arrives at the boundary, because this partner is somehow encoded in the boundary. So just in terms of the boundary CFT, how is the partner encoded? The answer was given, well, a proposal for the answer was given recently. How do I do this? I hope I don't need what's behind there. The paper is by Papadimas and Raju, November 12th. So let's just, the question is, how are the partners encoded in the boundary theory? So what they said is the following. They said, let's imagine that we form this black hole like this, and we have a state in the boundary that looks for some subset of the degrees of freedom very close to being a thermal state. In fact, we know, this was mentioned earlier, if we had an eternal black hole in ADS, it's exactly a thermal state in the CFT. If we have a, if we form from collapse a stable large black hole in ADS by throwing stuff in from the boundary, then we have a pure state in the CFT, but it looks a lot like a thermal state, but it's secretly pure. And if we form a small black hole, then we have some subset of degrees of freedom somehow in the boundary that look like they're in a thermal state, but the whole thing taken together is pure. So they suggest, these guys, to focus on the nature of that entanglement that makes the state look thermal. They said, consider the whole Hilbert space as decomposed of the boundary CFT in what they call the coarse and the fine factor. And this is supposed to be made up of some light gauge invariant operators. And this is all the rest. And this has got a huge dimension compared to this. This is like order n squared degrees of freedom, where n is the rank of the gauge group, and this is order 1 degrees of freedom. And it's perfectly possible that if you restrict the density matrix, the state for the whole thing, a pure state, to this factor, that it looks like a thermal state. So imagine we're in that situation, they said. Then that state can always be written using Schmidt decomposition in the following form. So there's this amazing linear algebra theorem in quantum mechanics. If you have a state in the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces, a pure state, you can always choose a basis in the first factor and a basis in the second factor, an orthonormal basis, such that the state is a superposition of a product of each of the basis vectors from the first factor times a particular correlated basis vector from the second factor with no ijs, no off-diagonal terms. And if the first factor is smaller, this would be, these guys would form an orthonormal basis. Whoops, basis for H coarse. And these guys would be some orthonormal set, but not a complete basis for H fine. Orthonormal set in H fine. So these guys in particular, you can think of as particular Hawking quantum states or states of the Hawking radiation. What they're correlated to is these guys. What this represents is all the other degrees of freedom in the boundary theory, that particular combination of them that happens to be correlated to this particular state of the coarse Hilbert space or of the Hawking radiation. So given this entanglement, they said, and I should really end this, you can, for any operator that acts on the course Hilbert space, you can construct an associated operator that acts on the fine Hilbert space simply by replacing this state with this state everywhere in the operator. This will be very obscure if I don't write just one equation or so. So let me, do I have another board in there? What? One more, so how do I get it? This is number two. And then, what controls that one? Okay, so for every operator that acts on the course space, I can write that as some sum of operator coefficients Oij in this particular basis. And I can just associate that or construct from that a different operator, O tilde, that acts on the course basis, I mean the fine basis, sorry, which is the same thing with complex conjugate. For a technical reason, replace this by the thing it's correlated to, J. These two operators commute with each other, and they argue in that paper that if this, and the algebra of these operators, if you have a bunch of them and they satisfy some algebra, then these guys are going to satisfy exactly the same algebra. So if these guys are chosen to correspond to the annihilation and creation operators of Hawking fluctuation quanta outside the black hole horizon, then this is going to be some other collection of operators that satisfies the exact same algebra that's, they postulate that this can be identified with the partner of the Hawking radiation, localizing it in space-time inside the horizon. So I shouldn't try. I've really run out of time here. So the point here is simply that if this story is true, it has to be possible to explain what we mean by this local picture near the horizon purely within the boundary theory. What they've proposed is the way that's done is to, in effect, construct the thermofield double of this effectively thermal subset subspace. And it must correspond to the inside of the horizon. Anyway, I highly recommend that paper. There's a lot in there. It's 72 pages long. This is not all they talk about. And I think I should stop there. And thank you for listening. And that's it.
Some clever way of like circumventing the no Xerox principle.
Yes, absolutely. He said, is this a clever way of circumventing the no quantum Xerox or cloning theorem? Yes, because that theorem applies to copying a quantum state onto another factor in Hilbert space. But the whole point here is we don't have another factor because the physical state space is not a tensor product of those factors.
Yeah, for this fine sector, are they representing a low energy sector or high energy sector? My concern is that if this cross sector covers all the low energy subspace, then it's hard to excite the other things. So it looks like this fine sector must be some low energy dark matter sector, which, you know, rather than some high energy sector. That's my concern for this picture.
Right. There have to be a lot of degrees of freedom that are not captured by these coarse grain Hawking quantum observables.
But the question whether our so-called Lorentz excitation capture all the Lorentz excitation. In the sense, whether photon, electron, etc. describe all the Lorentz excitation now. If all the Lorentz excitation are thermal, then
right.
there's no way to entangle with some other
right.
Lorentz excitation. That's a concern.
Well, I don't know very much actually about CFTs and so forth, but the statement is by them is that really the number of degrees of freedom of the light gauge invariant operators needed to describe what we think of as Hawking quanta reaching the boundary is very, very small compared to the number of degrees of freedom. Now you're saying, yes, but are all of those other degrees of freedom heavy? I think they're not. And I could use some help maybe from ADS CFT experts to make that explicit, like what kind of states are they? What do they look like? Are they long Wilson lines? Are they what soft modes do they correspond to? And, I don't think I know. On the gravity side, I think there should be a concrete answer to that. Like, what is it? How does the, you know, what aspect of the asymptotic gravitational field is the freedom that's being exploited here? And or is it true that actually you need the stringy degrees of freedom? I don't think you should because it's at low energy. So I think the question is valid. But again, because of the coherence of the logic, I feel like it's just a matter of finding the answer, not whether it's right.
Yes. Sorry. Just to follow up on, so am I to think that the coarse Hilbert space is sort of the stuff that we measure, and the fine is some hidden stringy degrees of freedom?
I don't think it's stringy. No,
it's not stringy.
It seemed like what they're saying is it's not just a question of other degrees of freedom, but it's more accurate measurements of the coarse grain degrees of freedom. So, if you measure something to accuracy, you know, the number of states in the entropy of the black hole goes like the exponential of the area.
Right.
You can count the number of states in that. And to keep track of all the information we're looking for, we'd have to measure what they said is either a huge number of things, correlators, or measure the correlators to extremely high precision. So when we say a coarse grain degree of freedom, it can be like a fuzzy description of a Hawking photon. Whereas the fine description of it is in the fine Hilbert space. You know, there are other qualities that it has, phases and relations that can be correlated to the other ones, to all the other degrees of freedom, that are not being captured in the coarse grained Hilbert space subspace. Which makes sense because it's probably not thermal in all of those extremely fine grained measurements. I don't think it's an energy ordering. It's somehow a precision ordering.
I mean, one way out of this is that information really is lost. The apps argument and so on. That's what Hawking used to say, right? That information really is lost. So what I'm confused about is the relationship in these arguments. I mean, on the one hand, one wants to reconcile the picture. But it seems to me, why couldn't someone construct a theory in which some theory of gravity, information really is lost in the black holes, in which case, what happens to that argument? Would it then be that you could never do that unless you destroy diffeomorphism invariants? Or what's going to go wrong if I want to break this cycle, so to speak? I realize the goal is to try and put things together. We don't know how, but then it seems to me there should be possible to write down theories where this screws up. Whereas it sounds like if this is right, I'm never going to actually be able to do that.
As long
what
as you have one theory for which
sorry?
As long as you have one theory of gravity for which there's a paradox, you've got to understand it. You know, it's really, you know,
yeah. So
but finding other theories does not solve this paradox.
Well, but I'm saying that it sounds like there isn't any theory in which there could be a paradox. That's what I'm kind of getting at. It seems to me there should be lots of theories where there are paradoxes, in which case, what's going wrong with this argument? Because it doesn't seem to depend on the theory of gravity.
Yeah, I think it needs to be unitary, it needs to be unitary, like UV complete, and Diffeo invariant. If it is, you're always not going to preserve information.
So you're never going to be able to do, unless you break one of those things, that would be the conjecture. That's basically what I'm getting at.
Actually,
you could
well,
UV complete it or something.
Or let's back off a little bit. Remember I mentioned, what about if there is no boundary? What if we live in a compact universe and we form black holes that are small compared to the size of the universe, but we can't retreat to the boundary and formulate a kind of unitarity of the S matrix argument? And maybe that's a setting where, I mean, then I don't even know how to formulate the observable. So I really, because I don't have the boundary, so I don't know, but.
But why couldn't I surround the black hole with my own little boundary?
Yeah, but R is not right.
Yeah.
Right, because then you don't have a limiting structure.
Yeah.
That's well, somebody was using the fact that you have time evolution is given by a Poisson bracket. And there's a, you know, so if you don't go to infinity, that was my. If you don't go to infinity, you cannot preserve the symplectic structure. Therefore, you don't have a unitary theory.
Sorry.
You
want boundary preserving diffeomorphisms where you can bring points out of the surface with all diffeomorphisms, but if it's a boundary, it's there.
But another way to say is that any finite boundary dissipates.
Okay,
I still think Ted's idea, you may not know how to formulate the problem, but intuitively, I don't see why we couldn't put a black hole inside that kind of space. Something's got to happen. The fact that we don't know how to do it doesn't mean it can't be done.
Right, but I would say, the thing is, are you talking about a compact without boundary?
Yeah, what you said.
The issue, though, is then even whether we make a black hole or not, I don't even know how to describe, anything in that space.
Well, I know, but that doesn't mean it can't be done.
I agree. It's just that the formulation of the question about unitarity will be very different because.
If this story is right, is the equivalence principle false? Near the horizon, physics should be exactly like Minkowski, but now we're saying it's not a direct product.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is false because just saying that what's happening at the horizon is also encoded in the same global state in other ways. In fact, it's really what it's black hole complementarity in a certain sense, which I never thought made any sense until I thought of it this way. And now it seems like that's exactly what it is. So I believe that if you go down and look at a horizon, this does not suggest in any way that you wouldn't see local quantum field theory. Maybe if you tried to make measurements that were infinitely precise there, such that you were probing too much, you might see some deviation.
No questions?
Then let's thank you.